My name is Dave Simpkins, editor and publisher of the Sox Center Herald, a newspaper that gave Sinclair Lewis his start. And I've been covering Lewis for about 25 years now and currently working on a book project about his childhood here in Sox Center.
My name is Joyce Ling. I've lived in Sox Center all my 79 years, and now I am president of the Sinclair Lewis Foundation.
And I'm Jolene Glennon, vice president of the Sinclair Lewis Foundation.
What are you doing here? What is this place?
It's the Sinclair Lewis Museum.
Ah.
And it shows a lot about how he wrote a book, like the illustration on the wall, where he put little notations in the outlines of it.
Uh-huh.
And he would go to cemeteries to choose names for his characters in his books.
Oh, he went to cemeteries to get the names?
To get names.
Ah.
Yes. Yeah.
Great.
Okay. A lot of those details are here in the Interpretive Center for people to look at. A lot of pictures. You can get a feel of Lewis and the process that he used in writing.
Talk to us a bit about Lewis's early years.
Well, they were fascinating years. They had tragedy in them. They had rejection and followed with a lot of opportunity and ambition. His mother died when he was 6 years old of tuberculosis in their home, which was a terrible death, and I think it was a terrible experience for him. He became very withdrawn, very awkward in school, didn't have many friends. And then his stepmother, Isabel, kind of brought him out of that little bit of a cocoon that he got into. And his father introduced him with books. Their home had probably, the saying is that they had more books in their house than the library had.
Yeah.
And, or else at least what was the custom of the time. And they read to him more than was the custom of the time. So books were a part of their family. In fact, one of their books was called The Many Loves of a Bibliomaniac. And Lewis kind of became a bibliomaniac of his own. And so she introduced him to the outside world. She came from Chicago. She was pretty much a social reformer in a lot of ways, similar to a character in Main Street that
Carol
developed later on. And took him a lot of, she was very involved in women's organizations in Minnesota, taking statewide positions and secretary and president of the Women's Federation.
Was she a suffragette?
Not quite. She was a moderate Republican, not necessarily a revolutionary, but a supporter of women in general, of good causes, of education of women. One project she had in this community and promoted another community was a restroom. The establishment of a storefront where women could go to. Usually the men would come to town with the women and they would go to the implement dealership or the grain dealer. The woman would buy the groceries and the clothing for the children. And the woman would come back to the wagon and wait for the men to show up. Then they would go to the bar and maybe be there for 2, 3, 4 hours. In a cold winter night with a horse blanket on you wasn't very comfortable. So they established the restrooms where women could go and be warm and with other women until the men were done drinking.
Yeah.
So that was one of her projects that she instituted.
Now, do you know much about his early writing efforts?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're proud of the fact that his first published work was in the Sox Center Herald. Did a couple of pieces. One included a report on the graduation class of 1902.
Wow. And when he would have been 17 years old.
Yes, but earlier than that, he got the bug to write, and he would submit poems to youth magazines. And in his diary, he reports that to be a good writer, you got to be willing to accept rejection. And I received a lot of that. And I think he did get published in a few youth magazines with poems and so forth. He submitted one that was an interesting story on the heating system. It was a coal-fired steam heating system in the house, one of the first ones in town. And he wrote an article on that for a home magazine.
Oh.
But probably his first big piece, he went off to college and he worked for the student newspaper and became president of the literary magazine on campus at Yale. And in that time, he did a piece, an article for a national magazine on an author who had written a book, but it was plagiarized. And he caught the plagiarism and did an article on it. And that created a little bit of a stir. And so he came home in 1905, and there was an article in the Star, in the Tribune, in the Herald about that, how he had exposed his plagiarism and kind of put a little feather in his hat.
Could you just repeat the story you told me about, was it 1905 when he and his friends went out to the park?
Mm-hmm. In 1905, he was a sophomore at Yale. He was home for the summer, and he hadn't come home the summer before, at 04. So instead, he went off to, he worked on a cattle boat. You know, that means cleaning out the manure of the cattle, feeding the cattle, you know, pushing the cattle around, you know, throwing out the ones that died. It was not a nice job. And he finished that job, of course, and he went home to his mother and he said, now I can do the job of a man. but he also got a lot of material for books. And in that 2 years that he was away from home, he was in New York City, he was meeting, you know, national authors in class, attending operas and plays, really becoming more worldly. And he was excited to come home. He had met Jack London in school, and Jack London said, if you want to be a writer, go home and write about what you know about. So he was excited to do that and came home, all excited to write about Sox Center, his home and the people. He sort of hit a brick wall. That boy, he didn't fit in. He was different. He had different ideas, different values. He felt that, you know, people in town were kind of stuck. They didn't look as with great joy that he looked at New York and the world about him. You know, they kind of looked down on those big cities and so forth. And he was, toward the end of the summer, he was in the park with a couple of guys drinking wine. And he came up with, well, he figured out what was wrong with the city, Sox Center. It was a virus. And he called it the village virus. You know, I wish I had the quote to read it to you right now, but basically that, you know, the devil created the village. And that the village virus is a syndrome that gets people stuck in their community and they don't really look beyond whatever. And he said, someday I'm gonna write a book about this. That was 1905. You know, 15 years later, he would publish Main Street.
Right.
And it would be the best-selling book in the history of America. Another interesting piece, he had an incredible ambition to be a writer. He lived to be a writer. He did everything he knew that he could do to be a writer. You know, read, take notes, study, observe, develop observation skills. He used to go around town and do something called psychological survey, where he would see somebody, a maid, a clerk in the store, a farmer, and he would interview them, asking them questions about, you know, their religious beliefs, political beliefs, what they did today, what, take notes about what they wore, you know, what was the best kind of horse to pull a plow, all those details, and take notes and gather those notes, everything he could think about to be a writer. And in 1910, that was, you know, 2 years out of college, he was working in newspapers, which he thought would be a good background for writing. And he said, you know, I'm ready to write. I want to be on my own. I don't want to be going to work every day. I want to be able to write, and I believe I can do it. So he wrote a letter to his father asking for a loan. And he said, I'll pay you back at 7% interest. And his father turned to him. He said, Dad, he said, I know what it takes to be a writer. It's hard work, but I am up to the challenge. I believe I can be as good in the writing game as the Mayo brothers are in the medicine game. Of course, his father was a doctor, could relate to the males, and he kind of, you know, laughed that one off. That was 1910, 10 years before Main Street, which became the greatest selling novel up to that time.
Quarter million sales in a year.
Yes, it made him $2 million in a couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, he was as big in the writing game as the Mayo brothers were in the medicine game at that time. You know, so it shows you that not only his ambition, but his ability to work. You know, he had working habits that were incredible. In high school, in the summer, he read as many as 50 books a summer. And in the summer of 1903, he read War and Peace and the Bible for the second time. You know, he had no problem working 10 to 12 hours studying and learning, working for his exams to go to Yale and so forth. And when he started writing, he was very disciplined, much like his father. His father was a disciplined doctor, showed up on time, studied his manuals, knew his stuff. And Lewis did the same thing. He'd like to, when he got out in the field and became a regular writer, he would rent an office. You know, he moved around a lot, and the first thing he did when he came into town, rent an office where he could go to work in the morning and write. sit down, and then go back in the evening, he would be done, whatever. He said, to be a good writer, you need to put the seat of your pants on the seat of the chair.
Which is something we've heard every writer we've interviewed say in one way or another.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Could you address, before you, I know you need to go, could you talk about the Jack London connection, since that was one of our earliest interviews, and we learned at that, during that interview, this connection with Sinclair Lewis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Sinclair Lewis met Jack London when he was at Yale. There was a pastor of the Episcopal Church where Lewis worked as a Sunday school teacher and assistant for the publisher. He was very much involved in the church at this time. And the pastor invited Jack London to come and speak. And so he came to the college and the church to speak, gave a talk, and a lot of the student body that attended it heckled Jack London as a socialist and, you know, hack writer and whatever. And so the talk didn't go over very well. So then the three of them, kids left, the three of them went to the pastor's rectory and visited. And London and Lewis struck up a friendship, had a lot of letters back and forth. And Lewis eventually started writing plots and selling them to Jack London. I think I have a letter where he sold a plot for $53. Mm-hmm. And there was a plot for that, the name escapes me now, but it was a mystery.
The Assassination Bureau.
Right. Yes, that's it, exactly.
Which was published posthumously.
Yes, yeah. And that was, and it's interesting, in the letters back and forth, London says to Lewis, he says, now, please remember which plots you sell to me so you don't turn around and write the same story yourself. But plots would flow out of him. Because of all that reading he did, that base of stories, he had a backlog of plots and ideas. And they just flowed from him.
One other question I have for you is, you're presently going through his journals.
Mm-hmm.
Did he keep journals all his life?
Off and on. He had the diary from about 1900 to 1908. The time of high school and college, basically, he kept his journals. And every day, religiously.
And do you find any hints of what is about to happen to this man? His story plots, his ideas?
Not as much coming out of the plots at this point. You know, I think that knowing his life and then reading the books, you see how his books reflect his life so much. You know, how the boyhood home is so much, comes alive in the books.
And did he experiment with style ever in his journals that you noticed?
They're pretty much just basic reports. A little bit, he starts in like 1903 or so now, he starts being more descriptive of nature and the environment, of people,
Have you had any?
That might be a paragraph or two.
Now, in you're going through these, and I understand you're going to be going to Yale to visit the actual papers and.
Be my second trip. It's the Mecca.
Tell us one of the great revelations you've had about Sinclair Lewis, or Harry, if we might say.
Yeah, I guess it was his incredible curiosity and his travels. In 1902, he's coming back from Oberlin College. He went to Chicago for Christmas, to spend Christmas with his brother and some relatives. And, you know, the kid is he's out of town, and he wants to see the world. So while he's in Chicago, he attends an evangelist rally of a new form of Christianity. It's actually called Catholic Christianity. And it's very Pentecostal. And actually, it's the start of the Pentecostal movement.
Oh.
You know? And you could say that is sort of I'm sure he drew on that for Elmer Gantry. You know? But also while he's in Chicago, he sees Teddy Roosevelt. There's a good description of Teddy Roosevelt, the bulldog Teddy Roosevelt. Goes out to the stock farms, goes to the museums, and then goes to the Chicago Tribune, wants to meet this famous crime reporter, ends up spending 2 days with him going out and investigating, crime stories in the city of Chicago.
As a teenager.
As a teenager. You know, he just has this incredible desire to understand and know the world. And that's what helped him become such a great writer.
Yeah.
You know, and his view of the world was outside the world. You know, Sauk Center was not big enough for him. I mean, he looks back at Sauk Center, loves the childhood he had, the connections. But he wanted a greater world. And you were talking about how he would be you know, the future of writing, the sense of writing. I believe from the reading of it, he was a bit of a techie. You know, they had a telephone, telephones were new, and his folks were away on vacation, and he has to take the telephone apart to figure out what makes it work. You know, he doesn't get to get it together again until just before the folks come back. You know, a little bit of a drama. He was one of the first kids in town to have a bicycle. Bicycles were sort of new at the turn of the century. He had a Rambler bike, which became eventually the Rambler car. But him and his friend Irv Fisher, they were trying to figure out how they could lash those two bikes together, put them on the railroad tracks, and head out west. Yeah. He always said was working on schemes to go somewhere. He wanted to. He ran away from home once to join the army during the Spanish-American War to be a drummer boy. He thought that would be a good experience. And his father went and picked him up at the depot and brought him back home again. Because he was like maybe 13 years old or something like that.
So what happened during World War I with him?
You know, I'm interested in learning more about, you know, he was basically a pacifist. Mm-hmm. He didn't like, you know, Hemingway went off of the war and had to capture the war. Lewis sort of avoids the war. The wars show up in the books. Most all of them going to mention both the war and the suffragette movement.
With mixed sense in how he handles that
exactly,
war.
Exactly. He was never a drum-beating, you know, war-type person. You know, his son Wells died in World War II.
Right.
You know, and he never really referred to it much.
Yeah.
He wasn't a flag-waving kind of patriot.
From the South.
And here's an interesting part. Okay, Lewis wasn't pro-German per se, you know, or anti-American, but he grew up in Sauk Center, a German community, a lot of Germans, Scandinavians, you know, basically his people in town were Yankees. But he always had a fascination with German in Germany. He studied German in school, he studied it with the priests, he had a pen pal in Germany, became fluent in German. And when World War I came along, everybody was demonizing the Germans. And he wrote a wonderful short story about a man, Broman Schenkel, Stearns County German dairy farmer who immigrated from Germany, came here with, you know, a sod hut and, you know, breaking the soil himself, and became a successful farmer. And he was proud to be a German American. But the war comes up, and you can no longer be a German-American. The Germans were bad, and they wanted him to give a loyalty oath, which was common in Minnesota at that time. I mean, some cases, we had like a lot of German Catholic schools, and no. You had to teach English in those German Catholic schools now. And Lewis took a lot of heat for that short story, basically being sympathetic to the Germans and saying, you know, these people are just good, hardworking Americans like everybody else.
And these books were in his father's office, and they belonged to his stepmother's family. And Sinclair would read these. These were his favorite books. And there were several volumes of Dickens and Sir Walter Scott.
Ah.
And he was fascinated by him, and I would imagine he was at a young age when they had these books.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, after Dr. Lewis died, and they had an auction and stuff, and then his belongings were broke up among the kids, then one of the children received these books, and he wasn't married. And then when he passed, it was given, he kind of thought that a distant relative on his stepmother's side or his grandmother's side would like to have these books. So they were there for 40 some years. They've had them, and just a couple of weeks ago they brought them into
now, where was there?
In Little Sauk is where they ended up, just up the road, and then from there they ended up in a basement in Minneapolis. So we're very fortunate to have them back.
So almost a century, or actually more than a century later, these books have gone full circle and returned to the rightful home.
Yeah.
And where are they going to go, Joyce?
I think they're going to go to the house. I don't, because I think they really were up in his doctor's office above the drugstore, right across the Palmer House.
I'm doing some research. I'm more of the genealogist, and I really like to get into the dirt. But anyway, Marcella Powers, said in a letter to Sinclair's niece, Red, and that's what she called him, was Red. Red Dickens, while I pasted stamps back in the 40s. He was good to my mother. He saw that her later years were comfortable and even glamorous. It was the kind of generous gesture he had, and he helped so many people in need. But that's interesting that he was still reading Dickens in the 40s, and he probably was still reading Dickens, you know, in the 50s.
Yeah, January 10th, 1951.
1951,
pardon. The same year I graduated from high school in Sussex. And he was buried on January 28th, 1951. Mm. They had a big funeral for him in the school auditorium. And then they took him out to Greenwood Cemetery. He had ashes, he was in an urn, like the urn isn't here in the museum. And as his brother, Dr. Claude Lewis, dumped his ashes into the ground, a wind came up in this cold day and blew a little bit of him away as a restless question of his life.
Out across the prairies.
Yes.
Yes. This was kind of cute. This was when Dorothy and Sinclair, shortly after they got married, and I'm sure they were living abroad. Anyway, he got lots of fan mail. This was right after he won the Nobel Prize. And so, of course, he's getting lots of fan mail from, I suppose, all kinds of women, you know. Well, anyway, this young lady writes, and she said, oh, I would just love to be your secretary, and I would do anything, everything for you, and I mean everything. Well, of course, Dorothy read this, but she wasn't too happy about that, so Dorothy took it upon herself to write back, and she informed the young lady that he had a stenographer. And as far as the everything, she was quite capable of doing everything herself. I just laughed because I thought, bless her heart.
You think if Sinclair Lewis were reincarnated today, do you think he would be accepted as a writer? Do you think he would get away with being a writer? Do you think he could walk out through this town and sort of... command?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. I think so, but you know how it used to be when I was growing up. 1947 was the last time he came to Sauk Center to visit his family. I was a sophomore in high school, but nothing was made of it, so I never went to meet him, and I really regret that.
Yeah.
And then his family blogged at Congregational Church, and he was doing a special speech for the 75th anniversary of the church. And I have in Roberta Olson's book, Sinclair Lewis, The Journey, there's a picture of me when I was 9 years old, sitting with my father and then listening to him, but I would have my hand on like this. I was very bored. I tried to remember that, but I can't remember it anymore.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
And then we just had a visitor here in the last month and found out that the University of Minnesota Theater and Arts Department has put on an opera of Elmer Gantry and taken it on the road, and they've won 2 Grammy Awards.
Really?
So we're hoping next summer to get them to come up here and do a fundraiser.
Right.
And do a mini version of the opera, but it's like, he just keeps going. That's what the world has to know. He just keeps ticking.
But that's true of all great writers.
Yes.
Dickens today and Mark Twain are still as read today as they ever were.
Yeah.
I really want to thank you guys, and of course the other guest who has already been here, for taking the time with us. It's been wonderful.
We just
can't thank you enough. It's been
really
exciting.
Fun.
Thanks.
Really fun. Thank you. Yeah.